with the mic unmuted. Okay. So last time we talked a bit about some course logistics. We mentioned we have labs starting next week. This week, just we want you to be able to do the lab next week. Kind of let technical stuff set up. And we'll have homeworks starting after next week's lab. And we'll have quizzes, which we'll talk about more on Thursday before it's released. So, course logistics, and then we talk a bit about sort of the basic idea of like what does a processor actually do? And we have this model where we said we have a processor that communicates with memory. So we have sort of this box we call the processor, and it's connected to the memory via a communication line that you might sometimes see called, you know, the bus or something like that. And sometimes we also have sort of I/O devices connected to this. And what our processor does basically is it asks for things over the bus. Some of those things are going to be machine code. It's going to interpret that machine code. That machine code is going to represent instructions in assembly, like we hopefully have seen before in 2150. And then it's going to do what it needs to do to run that instruction, so retrieving data from memory if it needs to, some instructions won't, and just keep doing that in a loop. And the processor is going to have some storage to do this, so it's going to have our registers and our program counter. Definitely needs to have the program counter, or else we can't know what to retrieve from memory. And usually we also have some sort of registers and scratch space that doesn't involve going to memory. And we mentioned in our preview of future things in the course that this model is a bit simplified, and there's some important things that are different in real processors that we'll get to later. For example, real processors try pretty hard to not always be talking to the memory on every instruction, because that's actually slow. Then we talked about, well, the memory. We had this memory, and we said that the memory was kind of like this big array of bytes. And this posed a problem because most of the time when we get things from the memory, we aren't actually asking for a single byte. We're asking for a bunch of bytes, and we're trying to interpret that as some bigger value, usually a bigger integer, not always. And when we're doing this, we have to make a decision about, well, how do we combine these different bytes we're getting into one big number? And there's kind of two ways we can do that. So one is this choice called little endian, where we say the lowest numbered part, so everything in our memory has an index, which we call a memory address. And in little endian, the thing with the lowest index is where the ones place is. And there's the opposite choice, which is called big endian, which is where the thing with the highest index is where the ones place is. And, you know, you'll see processors that do both. In this class, we're always going to use little endian because that's the choice that Intel made in the predecessor to the x86, kept with it. But both choices are reasonable. And in practice, there might be some processors that do like a third choice. Not that I'd recommend that. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so our main topic for today is going to be a little bit of review of assembly. So as I mentioned last week, most of you in theory know assembly from 2150. We're going to need some review, and perhaps more importantly, there's some topics that you didn't see in 2150 that we want you to know for this course about assembly. And one of them is that our textbook and some tools we're going to be using use AT&T syntax assembly, and usually 2150 focuses on Intel syntax. So we're going to have to talk about what AT&T syntax looks like. And here I have sort of a bunch of comparisons, but let's do sort of one simple example. Here I have an instruction in AT&T syntax and an instruction in Intel syntax. And what this instruction does is it moves the constant 42 into memory at a location which is specified by the register RBX. So RBX contains a memory address, and we're going to store the value 42 in that memory address, and we're going to interpret that value 42, you know, store 42, which is an 8, which is an 8-byte integer. So what would be a long in your typical C program? And this is, we have the AT&T syntax and the Intel syntax, and they're rather different. So we're going to go through the parts of the AT&T syntax here. So one thing to note here is that this is an instruction that moves a value to memory, and the location of memory is based on RBX. And probably the biggest thing that may be jarring if you're used to Intel syntax assembly is that the destination is less. So the part of this instruction that specifies where the value goes is the last part. And also, unlike Intel syntax, but maybe more similar, when we see parentheses, that means that this is specifying some sort of memory location, kind of like in Intel syntax, square brackets specify memory location. As we'll see later, these parentheses don't work really the same way as the square brackets in Intel syntax do. But in this example, they basically look the same for this sort of simple access. We have a constant 42, and I have this funny dollar sign in front of it. And that dollar sign is not sort of an optional decoration. We need it to indicate that this is a constant. If we didn't have that dollar sign, the assembly syntax says that instead 42 is a memory address. So the dollar sign represents, don't try to go to memory to get this thing. This is just a value that's a constant. You just put it in the instruction. We aren't looking for something at 42. We're looking for 42. When we specify registers, they're always going to start with the percent sign. If something doesn't start with the percent sign, if I just write plain RBX, that means I'm looking for, I have some label RBX, like a function called RBX. That's what that would refer to instead if I didn't have the percent sign. Not that I recommend calling a function RBX, but that's why they use the percent sign to kind of disambiguate that. And we have this instruction, it's not called MOV, it's called MOVQ. So in AT&T syntax, we can put the sort of length of the value being dealt with in the instruction as sort of a postfix to the instruction name. And Q indicates an 8-byte value, which stands for quad. You might say, wait a moment. It's 8 bytes. Quad sounds like 4. What's going on here? And so kind of the history is that when this sort of convention was designed, the standard value was 2 bytes. So quad is 4 times the standard value. Standard value called a word. And that's why if you want to represent a 2-byte value, you use move W. For a 4-byte value, move L for long. For a 1-byte value, move B for byte. As it's noted here, you can sometimes omit it. So this instruction, we can't, because if I write, say, move L RBX, if I write the same instruction but with an L instead of a Q, I'm saying to store an int, a 4-byte value, at that same memory location versus an 8-byte value. That's going to modify different amounts of memory. So those are two different instructions. So in this case, we need the Q, but in some cases, we're not going to need it because there's no other thing the instruction could be. So for example, if I have an instruction that, say, moves from RCX to RBX, to memory at RBX, that instruction has to move 8 bytes because RCX is an 8-byte register. We wanted to specify a smaller value. We need in sort of the way x86 works, we need to specify a different register name. Yes?
This is kind of a stupid question, but how would it be different if there were no parentheses?
Question, how would it be different if there were no parentheses? So the question is, what would move Q, $42, RBX do? Yeah. So that would take 42 and move it into RBX. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, am I saying the one with the parentheses and without the parentheses, they do the same thing? No. So with the parentheses, we access memory at the location specified by RBX. So let's say if RBX contains, for example, let's say RBX is equal to 10,000, this instruction is going to modify memory at address 10,000 hex to 10,007 hex inclusive, and the other version would modify no memory.
Wait, is the other version just going to replace the address with 42?
The other version would replace the 10,000 with 42, yeah. Yes. And it's not really 10,000 hex with 42, yes. The other version, like, only accesses memory to retrieve the machine code for the instruction. There's no other talking to memory in if we just remove the parentheses and have this version. People still look confused. So I assume there's more questions. Or maybe we'll figure it out later. Okay. So let's do a bit more complicated example of accessing memory. So I mentioned that these parentheses kind of look like square brackets in this simple case, but in the more general case, they work very differently. And here I have sort of two equivalent instructions, and we can see in the parentheses syntax, basically we have a bunch of slots to fill in, versus in the Intel syntax, you're used to writing a sort of an arithmetic expression and learning that some of them are allowed and some of them aren't. And there's like rules for that. And in AT&T syntax, the way it works is we just sort of have slots we can fill in, and the processor sort of does particular things with those slots, which are going to match what you could do with an Intel syntax, like what arithmetic expressions would be allowed, but kind of specified more directly based on what you might imagine is in the machine code. So one thing which might be a little disconcerting here is that we have this number outside the parentheses, and you might think, oh, we're going to access memory because that's what the parentheses mean, and then we're going to do something with 100, and that's not what it means. This 100 is part of the address computation for accessing memory. So in this case, we're going to add 100 after we compute the rest of the address, and then we're going to access memory. And where we access memory is, well, we have three values specified. The first is sometimes called the base register. So we're going to take the base register, and then we're going to add the second thing, which is sometimes called the index register times a value that's sometimes called the scale. And then we're going to add that value in front, which is called the displacement. And these are the names that like Intel's documentation uses and suggest what they're kind of expected to be used for by people writing assembly. So basically, you can think of this index as being like an array index. Because if my array elements are 4 bytes in this example, then this will advance me RCX elements in the array, because I'm doing RCX times 4 when I'm computing my address. So that's the intended use, but the processor just does the computation. It doesn't care if it's really an array. It's just going to do this computation to compute this value and send that to the memory to ask for, please give me the value here, or please change the value here. So questions? Yes.
What is the rule for what numbers are allowed for the scale?
What numbers are allowed for the scale? So this scale, this can be 1, 2, 4, 8. And basically the reason why is in the machine code format for this, there's the scale is not actually represented as 1, 2, 4, 8, but it's like 0, 1, 2, 3, and then there's no room. Yes, back there. Question, if I have the parentheses, it modifies the memory address itself. If I don't have the parentheses, it stores the memory address. I wouldn't look at it this way. So registers contain numbers. And depending on what instruction you're using with that register, we might interpret that number as an address in memory, or we might interpret it just as a number where we don't care. And when we're using anything with parentheses, that's going to be treating it as an address in memory because we're going to send that number to the memory and ask about it. Ask about the thing at that index. When we don't use any parentheses and just use a register name, that's going to just refer to the value in that register as a number, and we don't really care what that number contains. It could be an address, it could not be. Does that answer your question?
I think I have to look at it a little more.
Okay, we'll hear follow-ups later. And someone else had a question? I thought, yes.
So basically, in the AT&T syntax, RBX tree is a base, but in Intel, it's not treated as a base.
Question, in the AT&T syntax, RBX is treated as a base, and Intel is not? I would say it's in both. The difference here is just that Intel syntax tries to be nice and convenient by letting you write this arithmetic expression, and you have to know that, oh, there's only one thing about an expression that I can multiply by something, and they might, the assemblers there might be more flexible in the ways they let you write that. But ultimately, in the machine code, there's basically a slot for a base, a slot for an index, a slot for a scale, and a slot for a displacement. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Is displacement always 100?
Question, is displacement always 100? No, it's whatever, it's it could be any number you want it to be up to some size limit. I just have 100 in this example for the sake of having something that isn't 0 and isn't obviously related to 4. Yeah?
For the Intel syntax, could the 4 be, like, could you multiply RBX by 4, or would it?
So a question for the Intel syntax, could you multiply RBX by 4? I'm not familiar enough with Intel syntax assemblers to know, but I would assume that if I did this in Intel syntax, that it would, the assembler would know to turn it into what would in AT&T syntax be RCX, RBX, 4, because that is a possible instruction. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yes, back there.
So it's taking the number at RBX, then adding the number at RCX, then multiplying it by 4, then adding 100, and then going.
The question is, so it's taking RBX, adding RCX, and multiplying by 4, so I would say it's adding the quantity RCX times 4, and then we're adding 100 to that, and that gets us an index to go into memory, and then we're modified around that index memory to put the value 42 in. Because this is a move Q, or an Intel syntax move Q word, we're not just modifying the value at that address, we're modifying that and 7 more bytes. Yes? The question is Intel syntax more flexible? Both of these have to go down to the same machine code.
Right.
So they are exactly as flexible because if you try to, for example, in Intel syntax, let's say you try to replace the times 4 with times 3, the assembler is going to tell you that instruction doesn't exist, sorry. Because there's no machine code for it. Or if you like try to add another register in there, it's going to say, sorry, that instruction doesn't exist. Because there's no way for it to convert that to machine code. So even though the syntax might let you represent things, you know, that doesn't mean there's machine code for it. And this also happens with AT&T syntax. Like, I could specify a scale of 3. If I try to assemble that, the assembler is going to say, there's no way for me to write machine code for that, sorry. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's this difference of the formula of the Intel syntax matters. Like if you, whether I can put like 100 in the front end, then add RBX and RCM.
Question, does the order in the Intel syntax matters? I don't think it does, but I not use Intel syntax assemblers. The assembler like just needs to figure out a way of generating, you know, sort of the machine code, which is going to have like a base slot, an index slot, a scale slot, and a displacement slot. And potentially it can like do a little algebra to figure out how what you wrote matches to that. Other questions? Okay. So I showed here sort of the most general form, well, the most general form we'll deal with in this class of specifying a memory location. And it turns out that you can omit most of the parts of this, and it will basically give default values for the omitted parts. So the index will default to 0 instead of a register value, the scale will default to 1, the base will default to 0 instead of a register value, and the displacement will default to 0, which I don't show here. So mostly this is kind of straightforward. So if I don't specify an index and a scale, they're basically as if the index is 0. The scale doesn't matter. Some cases that you might see in assembly that come up, if you specify a register and a scale, that registers the index, not the base. But you can be kind of very explicit about that by just having an omitted field for the base, which is what I prefer, but often you'll see the other syntax. And also, if you don't specify any parentheses, because remember, constants use dollar signs. So the bare 100 is not a constant 100, it's a memory location 100. So it's going to access memory at address 100. Yes?
So if it's only like 2 of them, like RBX and 8, the RBX would be the index?
Question, if it's only two things, a register and a scale, then the register is the index, yes.
And
the 8 is the scale, yes.
Okay.
You can't make, the base and index always have to be a register, so if you ever see a number in there, a constant in the parentheses, it's always a scale. Yes?
There's no way to treat a register value as a scale?
There's no way to treat a register value as a scale? That's correct. Because the machine code doesn't support it. Yes? Question, is there any difference between the second and third lines? Nope, they're just different ways of writing the same thing. Other questions? People still look confused. Hopefully. Okay, so one other thing about AT&T syntax, which technically is implied by what I told you earlier, but is definitely worth mentioning explicitly. And the thing I told you earlier is, oh, the destination is last. And one consequence of that is that the subtract instruction has the operands in a different order. But it's still the same subtract instruction. So the way I would read this is that this is subtract RAX from R8. And compare is, as we'll learn a bit later, actually kind of just secretly a special version of subtract that doesn't modify registers. So compare is going to compare based on the result of this subtraction. Questions about subtract order? And as I mentioned with addresses, if you have a bare number, that's kind of just the full displacement base index scale with the base index and scale omitted, so it's a memory location. If you mean a constant, you need a dollar sign. So the first add instruction here is going to access memory at address 1000 hex, get a value, add that value to REX and store the result in REX. The second instruction here is going to take the value in REX, add 1000 hex to it, and store the result in REX. both potentially useful instructions, but very different in what they do. Okay, and that's sort of my summary. So questions about AT&T syntax? Yes? Question about adding the memory of REX. So neither of these instructions use REX to form a memory location that is accessed. So in both cases, we're just taking the value of REX, adding something to it, and storing the result in REX. The difference is sometimes the something is a value which is just a constant, and sometimes the something is a value which we retrieve from memory. Does that answer your question? Question in general, registers store the memory. I would not say that. So our registers store numbers, and we can interpret those numbers in different ways depending on how we use the registers. So in this instruction, we're not using REX in any way which suggests that it must be something that's an address. It could be an address, but there's nothing in this instruction that's like implies it must be an address, because we're not actually using it to access memory. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So if you have, like, instead of an index form, like a decimal form 20, or if I go to hex 0 at 14?
So the question is, if I wrote 20 in this case, would it use 20 as a decimal number in both cases? Yes.
So for
the first one, it would go to address hex 14 or decimal 20, and the second one would add 20 or hex 14, yes.
Okay. Why don't we need parentheses around percent
REX? So if I put parentheses around REX, that's a different instruction. So in this case, I'm modifying REX. If I had this add instruction with parentheses around REX, this modifies memory at the index specified by REX. Does that answer your question? Okay. That's my AT&T syntax summary. Yes?
When you return a function, would you return REX in parentheses or not?
Question, when I return a function, do I return REX in parentheses or not in parentheses? The return value in the calling convention we use on x86-64 Linux uses the register REX for the return value. Now, of course, you know, if you're returning a pointer to something, then the value you're really, quote unquote, returning might be pointed to by REX. But I would say, like, another way of thinking about it is using percent REX is like the same as using REX in assembly, and using in Intel syntax, using parentheses REX is the same as using brackets REX. Right. But REX is our return value register. So that's where, you know, in our calling convention we expect the return value to be. Other questions? Okay, so one other thing that will come up in the assignment next week, where you're looking at some debugger stuff in AT&T syntax, is computed jumps. So just because they use this star here, and this star is just representing that this doesn't jump to like code in REX, it jumps to code at a location specified by REX. This is another way of kind of saying there's indirection. So this first instruction is use REX as a location of machine code and go to the machine code that's there. And the second instruction here, well, we have, after the star, we have this thing that specifies a memory location. We know it specifies a memory location because it uses that displacement-based index scale with parentheses syntax we saw earlier. So what's going to happen is we're going to read from that location, and it doesn't contain machine code. It contains a pointer to machine code. And we'll talk very briefly later about why would a compiler ever want that second instruction? But it is something you're likely to see on the assignment next week. Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the star indicates that there's some indirection, in this case that we aren't jumping to code in REX itself, we're jumping to code pointed to by REX. Or in the second case, we aren't jumping to code at that memory, at that location in memory, but pointed to by that location. Other questions? Okay. So let's do a little example with simple. Here's a swap function. So in the calling convention that we use on 64-bit Linux, our first first argument is an RDI, our second argument is an RSI. And so this is a function written using that calling convention. And it uses REX and RDX as temporary registers. This function presumably returns void, so we aren't really concerned about the return value. And it swaps two longs that are passed by a pointer. And remember that in our AT&T syntax, so the destination is last, so if I convert it to infill syntax, everything, the operands are swapped versus what you see in AT&T syntax, and these parentheses represent a value in memory. So we can think of what this does is our first instruction is going to use RDI as a place to access memory. It's going to read 8 bytes there, copy it into REX. Second instruction is going to do the same with RSI. And then we're going to copy out of RDX and RAX back into memory, but in the swapping the values. So as an example of what that might look like is, let's say our initial values are that RDI contains address 4000, RSI contains 4030, and I have here my partial contents of memory. And for convenience, rather than representing memory as an array of bytes, I've represented it as an array of longs. So we don't have to do all the endianness thing. I've just done that in advance. Do all the conversion of dealing with endianness in advance, so we don't have to do it again. So our first step here, this move parentheses RDI to REX, we're going to take RDI. We're going to use that as a location to access memory. So it's 4000. We're going to go to the long at address 4000. We're going to get this value, which is this hex number with a bunch of nines, and we're going to put that in REX. So that's what that first instruction does. And our second instruction is going to do the same thing, but with RSI and RDX. So we're going to go to address 4030, get a value out of there, and put that into RDX. Then we're going to go in the opposite direction. So this next instruction takes the value in RDX, and we're going to send it into memory at a location specified by RDI, which is 4000. So we end up having putting that all sevens value at address 4000. Then we're going to do the same thing with RAX and RSI. And finally, we're going to return, which is going to, if as you might remember, and we will remind you later in this class, is going to modify RSP and jump to some other location. Questions? Yes?
Just for clarification, did you say that the Intel syntax is just switched where the destination is first and source?
Question, when I say the Intel syntax is just switched, that is one of the differences between the Intel and AT&T syntax. I would say the address specification is maybe a bigger issue. But other questions?
So here it looks like all the registers contain memory addresses. So how do you know when to use parentheses?
Question, here it looks like all the registers contain memory addresses. So how do I know when to use parentheses? So that decision is made by the compiler because the compiler knows, whether you were trying to use the value as a pointer or a number. And if you're producing assembly by hand, you probably would think in the same way, right? That you wrote this function, you know whether the person calling it is going to give you pointers or numbers. And that's how you know. The processor doesn't inherently know that, you know, that this value here is a pointer or is a number. It doesn't, there's no real difference until you try to use it with as an address or not as an address. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What does the return instruction do? So the return instruction, which I hope is covered in 2150, this pops an address from the stack and jumps there. And the call instruction does the opposite. It pushes the address of the following instruction on the stack and then jumps to a different a function. Yes?
Could you go over again what happens when a value in the register is a destination? Like where the parentheses come
from? Can I go over what happens when the parentheses is the second operand? So here, for example, our destination is parentheses RSI, so we use RSI as a memory location, and that's the memory location the instruction modifies. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
I always thought return just return REX. You said it.
Thought return just returned REX.
Is that like a yeah.
Return so question is does return just return REX? And the answer is no, it does not. That's not really what it does. So return is just a function that changes where our program counter is. The notion of the return value, that's defined by what the code that we return to does. So if that code, for example, instead of using REX, use something else, then we'd in fact be returning a value in a different register. So the return instruction doesn't care about the return value because all it does is it jumps to the code that called us. So all the stuff about how the code that calls us figure out what we're returning, that's defined by what the code that calls us does. And our convention is that that code is going to use REX, but if it followed a different convention, we could use the same return instruction and it would still work. Does that answer your question? And also, I just realized I wasn't recording the first 38 minutes of video. Great. Have audio, but not video. Okay. Okay, so that's this example here. I guess at least attendance is high, so not many people seeing it. We have the slides. Okay. So another thing to briefly mention is this is something that you saw in 2150, that we have kind of names for different parts of registers. So for example, we have REX, and we also have a name for the bottom, I guess, so this least significant 32 bits of that called EAX, and a name for the least significant 16 bits of that called AX, and a name for the least significant 8 bits of that called AL, and also a name for the next 8 bits called AH. And there are similar names for all the registers. Some people don't remember the ones for R8 through R15. So for R8, we have R8D is the 32-bit part, R8W is the 16-bit part, R8B is the 8-bit part. And these are just names for subsets of the registers that we kind of treat as a register. Yes?
Why is the max 63 not 64?
Why is the max 63... like and not 63, because I'm labeling this by this bit and not this bit.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Let's say we're moving move L to register RAX. I don't know if I saw this in the results, but am I correct to say that it modifies up to
So the question is, if I move into EAX, how many bits are modified? And based on this diagram, it would appear, oh, I just modify the lower 32 bits. But the rule for that is a little different, and not in an intuitive way. And I'm mentioning it not because we're going to test you on it, but because when you're like using a debugger or something, this might come up. When you're looking at compilers' output of code, they take advantage of these rules. So one of the rules is that when we set a 32-bit register, that clears the corresponding, the rest of the corresponding 64-bit register. So for example, if I move 1 into EAX here, where REX was set to all 1s, that's going to clear the upper most significant bits of REX as a rule. But doing the same thing with AL or AX doesn't. You might say, why is it inconsistent like this? Probably the reason is that the rules for what happens with 32-bit registers were made in the early 1000s, late 90s, when AMD was adding 64-bit support to a 32-bit x86, and the rules for what happens with 16 and 8 bits were made like in the 80s, when there were different considerations for what made sense. So the rules are different. I'm sorry they're inconsistent. I mention this mainly because you'll see compilers take a lot of advantage of the fact that setting EAX and similar things will clear REX or similar things. Yeah.
So not only the names are inconsistent, this like artifacts from the past.
The question is, this is artifacts from the past? Yeah. So there's all the naming being kind of weird here is also, yes, based on kind of a history, like as you might guess, there used to only be 8 registers. So.
Wait, my question is more like not only the names, but the property to clear the.
The question, the properties cleared are also artifacts of history, yes. A lot of the x86 instruction set is based on its storied history. Yeah, and as I said on the slide, my guess is that. For reasons that we can't really explain at this point in the course, but we might be able to explain when we talk about out-of-order processors, it's probably a lot faster to have the instruction clear the rest of the 64-bit register for many processor designs. But that wasn't true in the processor designs that were common in the 80s. Yes? Question, the second line move L clears the rest of clears the entire REX? Yes. So the top bit, so moving into EAX means that the bits that aren't covered by EAX, so these bits here, are all set to zero. Yeah.
So what if you modify the second instruction from
Question: if what if I made the made the second instruction move L OX1 REX?
Yes.
This would not assemble.
Okay.
Your assembler would say, "How do you expect me to move a 32-bit value into a 64-bit value?" That's not a thing. There are instructions for moving a value after adding zeros or sign extending it. But that's not the normal move instruction. Yeah?
Can you explain why does REX move REX to 0 and so many that clear the register?
Question, why does move REX into... Why does it clear the register? This is just an arbitrary rule that AMD made when they added 64-bit registers. Yeah? Can we move B into AH instead of AL? Yes.
So in that condition, you would still want.
The question is, if I moved into AH, I'd end up with OXFF, FF, 01FF. I don't recommend using AH, but it exists. It's kind of a thing which, well, it's not likely to be implemented efficiently these days. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I guess I alluded to the calling convention earlier, so just this is just a reminder of what the calling convention is. You've seen it in 2150, and you don't need to memorize this. You can look it up when you need it. But we're going to use the Linux 64-bit calling convention in this class because we're going to do our assignments. And they have a rule that the first six arguments go in RDI, then RSI, then RDX, then RCX, then R8, and R9. If the arguments are smaller than 64 bits, they go into the smaller register parts. If there are more arguments, they go on the stack. They're pushed before the return address is pushed. And the convention is the return values in RAX. And this is a convention, meaning that the hardware doesn't actually do anything besides how the call and return instructions work that kind of force us to use this, right? We could have used something, instead of using RAX, we could have said the return value goes in R8. And as long as everyone calling functions and using function return values obeys that, everything would work. So this is a convention because none of this is really fixed by the hardware. The hardware doesn't decide where the arguments go. We do it when we're writing assembly that either implements functions or calls functions. And this is the convention we're going to follow to be consistent with other people writing assembly. And that's why we're going to have to use it on Linux, because if you want to call other people's functions, you better expect arguments the same way they did. Questions on our calling convention? I have a little example here. So when we call a function, we move into, so here I have three integer arguments, so I move them into EDI, ESI, and EDX. I do a call. In this case, we return 42 without looking at the arguments, so I move 42 into where I expect the return address, which is EAX. And then I can use that in the section labeled dot, dot, dot after the call. Questions? Okay. We also have a call and return instruction. And what the call instruction does is it pushes the address just past the end of the call instruction onto the stack. We call this the return address, because this is where we want to go back to. And the return instruction pops this address from the stack and jumps. So this is what the x86 provides us to help us implement function calls, because we probably going to want something like that. Questions about call and return? Okay, yes?
Where does it jump to after return?
Where does it jump to after return? It jumps to the address it just popped. So another thing about a calling convention is we need to know what registers a function can use and what registers it can't. And we have some registers that we say a function must preserve, meaning that if I call foo and foo returns, I expect the register to have the same value. And the way that's going to happen is that whoever implements foo is going to make sure they save the value of the register somewhere and then restore it before they return if they're going to modify it. So if they're going to use R12, they're going to save it somewhere and restore it. In the case of RSP, they're going to make sure the stack pointer goes back to where it used to be before they return. And so on. And they just made a rule that we're going to divide up the registers, say some of them the function has to worry about, and some of them, when we call a function, we have to worry about. And a way you might implement this is you might say that, well, R12 is a callee save register. Callee is not caller, so callee is the thing being called. So in this case, foo is being called. So if foo wants to use R12, it should save it somewhere. In this case, we're saving it on the stack and restore it when it returns. So my other function that calls foo doesn't notice that R12 changed. And similarly, if the other function wants to use R11 across this function call, well, foo is allowed to change it because it wasn't on that list of callee save registers. So if we care about it having the same value after the call, we need to save it ourselves. In this case, we chose putting it on the stack. That's not the only option, but if we did nothing, then foo is allowed to change R11 according to this calling convention. Yes.
This is all still by convention and not enforced anywhere, right?
Question, if this is all by convention and not enforced anywhere, yes. So for example, some operating systems might have a different set of save registers. In fact, I think some, in fact, do. Like, this is on Linux, so, like, Windows might choose a different list of registers. That answer your question? Yeah.
What's the difference between caller and callee save?
What's the difference between caller and callee save? So caller is the one making the call, and callee is the one being called. So the callee is the, if you are called, you are responsible for making sure they don't change before you return. Caller is that if you care about them, you are responsible for saving them yourself because the thing you're calling might change them for you, up from under you. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, when the return instruction pops the value from the stack, can it ever pop the wrong value from the stack? I mean, so if you do something like, if you push a value to the stack without call and do return, return's going to pop the value you just pushed. So if you want to return to behave the way you probably expect, then you probably want to make sure that, when it's run, the stack pointer points to something that was written by call. But if it isn't, it's defined how it works, and it's going to pop a value, whatever that value is, and it's going to jump there. So you can also kind of use it as a funny computed jump if you wanted to, or maybe unintentionally use it as a funny computed jump if you're making bugs in your assembly. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So one other thing we're going to talk about is labels. So labels are sort of names of typically things where we have like foo colon and like some instruction that's marked with a label. So this is our label. And labels represent addresses. So this means that you can kind of replace a label with the address that it represents. So in this case, foo represents the address of this move queue instruction. So in this example here, let's say string is at address 1000x. This add instruction would then be the same as add 1000 to REX. And this second add instruction would be the same as add the constant 1000 to REX. And if you remember what we talked about earlier, the first one is going to access memory at 1000, retrieve a number from there, and add it to REX. Probably doesn't actually make very much sense with this string, because we're going to interpret the ASCII a string as like a long, and then add that to REX. But it's a valid instruction. It's well-defined, so the processor will do it for you. The second one is going to use the address of the string just as a constant. We're not going to have access memory, and add it to REX. So that might be something that would be useful if, let's say, we were computing the address of one of the bytes in the string. But REX started as, 2. It would get us the address of the S. But the sort of big thing here is that this label, like string here, when we use it in an instruction, it represents the address that that label marks. So in this case, the address of a string, wherever it's going to end up when we run this program. Some questions? Sure, so let's do a little example here. So here I have an alternate string, and in this case, I'm calling puts, which is a function that takes a pointer to an alternate string and writes it to the terminal. And how is this function going to be called? Well, because this is the same as, if this is located at address 1000, this is the same as moving the constant 10000 into RDI. This is passing a pointer to point us to that string. We're not accessing the string itself, we're just passing, getting the address of it, stashing it in RDI so put us can presumably access it. Questions? This use of labels and how they sort of correspond to writing the address of the thing. Yes? So question is they, you mean put s has to use the pointer to access the address?
Yeah.
So put s is going to use that address, yeah, and presumably put s is going to have some code that does, something like move a byte from RDI into somewhere. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
What happens, say, if there isn't a dollar sign before the hello?
What happens if there isn't a dollar sign before the hello? So in that case, we'd have sort of this would be equivalent of move into 10000 into RDI. And if we think of how this string is represented at address 100, we have the ASCII for H. At 10001, we have the ASCII for E, and so on. And we're going to take 8 bytes, so 8 of those ASCII characters, and we're going to interpret them as a 64-bit number, based on little endian, and then we're going to put that into RDI. Probably not what you wanted, but it is well-defined. Does that answer your question?
And so with the dollar sign, it instead takes the memory address that hello sort of is at?
Question with the dollar sign, it takes the memory address hello is at? Yes. Rather than accessing it right away. Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So here I have a little assembly code that does some stuff before calling put s, and my question is, what is the argument to put s when it's all done? You can talk with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's going on.
Thank you.
Okay, so who likes more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks it should be A, B, okay, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. Okay, so first let's go over sort of do some high-level stuff here. So RDI, before it put S, is set by this instruction here. And we have this dollar sign here. So this is going to put the address. So this is equivalent to, if let's say the string is at 1, 2, 3, 4, this is equivalent to moving the constant 1, 2, 3, 4 into RDI. So it has the address of the string, not the value of the string converted to a number. If we didn't have the dollar sign, it would be the value of the string converted to a number. So then we have the question of, well, that's the first six options. What is the string? And we have this code above here, which is doing a bunch of stuff with hello. And the question is, well, does this change the string? And well, let's look at the destinations of these instructions. BL, that's not going to be in the part of the string. That's not a memory location. That's a register. And BL. And then hello. Okay, so we're modifying some part of the string with that last move, that move B instruction here. And it's a move B, so this is 1 byte. And we're moving into hello. And if we think of how this string works, the H is going to be the thing at hello, and the E is going to be the thing at hello plus one and so on. So I have the sort of worked out version here. So what happens here is that we have this BL gets moved into replacing the H. So our H is hello. So let's say it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then hello plus 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is going to be the E. Hello plus 2 is going to be the first L and so on. Because each of our ASCII characters are one byte. So here, this moves from the address hello plus 1, which is going to be the E, into BL. So BL is going to contain the ASCII for E. And then we subtract 1 from that. Remember, this is subtract from. And so it becomes D, because if you look at an ASCII table, E and D are helpfully next to each other. And then we move that value back to replace the H. So we end up with this Dello world. Some questions on how I figure that out? Yes. So before this line, so this is basically is doing BL gets BL minus 1. And the old value of BL was the ASCII for E. And the new value is going to be the ASCII for E minus 1. So if we look at an ASCII table, we'll like look up E as some number. We subtract 1 from that number. We look it up again in the ASCII table. It will be a D because E and D are next to each other in the ASCII table. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but I thought
the question is, why is there a dollar sign in the subtract B instruction? So if we didn't have a dollar sign, what we'd be saying is access memory at address 1. And that's a value I want to subtract from BL. And that wouldn't make much sense because probably there's nothing useful stored in memory at address 1, but it would be a valid instruction. Okay. Yes? Question, if I wanted to subtract 1 from the pointer, how would I do that? So first, I need to get the pointer into some sort of register, which I'm not doing in this example, until I move it into RDI. But for example, after I move hello into RDI, then I could like subtract 1 from RDI. And that would be subtracting from a pointer because RDI is a pointer. Does that answer your question? In this case, I don't think subtracting 1 from the pointer to the H is very useful because we don't know what's before it in memory. But yeah. Yes?
So it's safe to think about that new key with dollar sign hello into RDI as moving a pointer to hello into RDI?
Question, is safe to think is the move key dollar sign hello into RDI as moving a pointer to hello in RDI? Yes. So you can think of the first operand as being a pointer, I guess, but we're dereferencing it because there's no dollar sign. Does that answer your question? For the move B at the top, yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
So the dollar sign can sort of mean two things. If it's in front of like a number, then that just means that number is a constant. If it's in front of like a, I guess more or less anything else, that's like where it is in memory.
The question, the dollar sign means two things in front of a number, that's a constant, in front of anything else, that's where it is in memory. That's not how I'd look at it. So I would say when we write the name of something, that refers to its address. And when we use an address in assembly, by default, we're accessing memory at that address. And the dollar sign undoes that and instead just uses the address directly as a pointer. So when we have a bare number without a dollar sign, we're accessing memory there. We have a number with a dollar sign or a name with a dollar sign, we're using just that. We're using that that number directly or using that address directly, the address of that thing directly. But sort of a step you can take is that like this would behave the same if hello is at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can just replace hello with 0x 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 everywhere in this assembly, and it will do the same thing. Does that make things clearer? So I can just like find replace hello with its address, and the assembly will behave the same. Other questions, follow-ups? Yes. The address hello refers just to the first character. So hello is a label that is the address of the age.
Yes.
I would say it's also the address of the whole string because we refer to the string using the address of its first character. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so in our last 2 minutes, we'll talk about briefly about one topic which we'll do some exercises on next time. So LEA is an instruction you've seen in 2150 that is a big point of confusion because it looks like a move, but it doesn't actually access memory. And you can kind of think of it as kind of like the address of the ampersand an array operator in C. So it computes an address, and normally we'd access memory at that address if it was a move or an add or something, but instead we just put that address in its destination. So in this example here, we compute the address 4 plus REX, displacement of 4, base of REX, and rather than actually going to memory there, we just put that number in REX. So this is basically like an add. And the thing that confuses people about this is, well, the processor is just going to compute this number, and it's not going to access memory, so it's going to put the number of computes in the destination. And because it doesn't access memory, it doesn't care if that number is actually a valid memory address. And this means that you'll see compilers taking advantage of LEA to do things that are just math. So for example, if you ask a compiler to multiply by 5, it could use the multiply instruction, but hey, we can do this memory address computation that's not really an address computation because base of REX, index of REX, scale of 4, that's REX times 5. And the compiler will do this because it turns out that in x86, this is the fastest way to multiply an integer by 5. And it doesn't matter if it's not a valid memory address because the processor never talks to the memory to execute this instruction. So it doesn't care that, yes, if you dereference the pointer there, your program would crash. Doesn't care. Okay, so that's where we're going to finish this time. We'll talk more about this next time. I'm sorry I don't have a video recording for the first hour because I apparently can't configure my computer. But we'll deal with that.
Thank you, Timmy.